Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Art Goldhammer on the political and economic prospects for France under its new president, François Hollande. And at the bottom of the hour, journalist Eliza Featherstone discusses school reform in the USA, testing and charters and all that in this deeply capitalist and anti-intellectual society. Not much time for economic commentary except for this. On Monday, we learned that retail sales in June in the U.S. declined for the third consecutive month. Streaks of three consecutive declines in retail sales are quite rare and almost always found in or around recessions. While I don't think we're in or even approaching formal recession, this is yet another sign that the economy remains quite troubled. Yes, I know that shopping does not necessarily equate with human welfare or happiness, but we live in an economy that remains very dependent on high levels of mass consumption, and we've yet to make the structural changes necessary to change this. Something remains very broken, and we're barely even admitting it in public, much less talking about what to do about it. Okay, 2 months ago, François Hollande took office as the 24th president of France. A nominal socialist, Hollande took over from the failed right-winger Nicolas Sarkozy. He faces a country that's not exactly thriving, though not doing as badly as many of its European neighbors. Politically, his center-left socialist party faces a challenge from those to the left of him, but more from the far right, led by Marine Le Pen, who last year inherited the leadership of the party that her father founded, the crypto-fascist National Front, or Front National, for those of you who say Paris. To analyze all this, we'll hear from Art Goldhammer, a senior affiliate at the Center for European Studies at Harvard University, who blogs on French politics at Art Goldhammer, one word, Art Goldhammer, blogspot.com. That's artgoldhammer.blogspot.com. Art Goldhammer. Welcome, Art. I just read that Hollande has reversed an exemption on taxation of overtime pay that was introduced by his predecessor, Sarkozy. What's this all about?
Well, Sarkozy had imposed this exempted overtime pay from taxes in an attempt to encourage the French workers to work more. His election slogan in 2007 was work more in order to earn more. Now, the criticism of this plan was that it encouraged employers to use existing workers in overtime situations rather than hire new workers. So it did increase pay for about 9 million French workers who were receiving additional pay for their overtime work, and it encouraged workers, employers to offer more overtime. But the criticism, as I said, was that it discouraged new hiring.
The socialists, didn't they encourage a shortening of the work week in order to encourage employment some years ago?
Yes, that goes back to 1997 when the Jospin government came in, and one of their major reforms was the reduction of the work week to 35 hours. That 35-hour work week is actually rather misleading. The average actual work week in France is about 37 and a half hours, only slightly shorter than the average German work week. There are legal rules surrounding the actual time that one works, and there's compensation time for working more than 35 hours per week. But most French workers do work more than 35 hours. So that wasn't the major target of the exemption of overtime pay from taxes.
Did this shortening of the work week actually have any effect?
It did lead to an increase in overtime hours. And as I said, about 9 million workers were which is about a third of the workforce, were collecting an additional pay that has been estimated at about 100 euros per month. So not a significant effect, probably less than 1.5%, 2% for the average worker.
All right, let's talk about the general situation of the French economy. French interest rates have come down some, so it looks like there's less of a panic about France than there might be otherwise. But how serious a situation is the French economy in compared to the rest of Europe?
Two comments. First of all, the fact that French interest rates have come down to the point where they're actually borrowing money at negative interest rates at short term is actually a reflection of the depth of trouble that the entire European economy is in. The reason for those negative interest rates is that capital has been fleeing from Spain and Italy, and France looks relatively healthy compared to those economies. So France has been able to alleviate its borrowing situation somewhat. So that's good for the French budget and reduces somewhat austerity pressures in France. But the French economy is not doing well overall. Its most serious problem is a current account deficit that's running about 3 to 3.5% of GDP at the moment. And it really needs to do something to bring trade back in balance. It's been losing, particularly in auto exports. Its auto industry has been suffering terribly. And you may have heard that PSA Peugeot plant at Aulnay, which employs about 8,000 workers, is now slated to close. That was announced just this week. So an undetermined number of workers are going to be out of jobs, ranging up to 8,000, although Peugeot has promised to shift some of those workers to plants elsewhere in France.
If you listen to a lot of American conservatives, I think France is a total wreck. Is that a fair point of view?
No, that's not fair at all. France does have a very large tax bite and a very substantial welfare state, but that welfare state is strongly supported by both the left and the right in France. Universal medical care has been a fact in France since the end of World War II, and no one wants to see it go. The political argument in France is what needs to be done in order to keep the economy viable and able to support both the welfare benefits and the free education benefits, free higher education, which is available to anyone in France who passes the baccalaureate degree and graduates from high school, can get a free college education. So those benefits are prized, and the French want to do what's necessary to keep it. They are suffering, as all the European economies are suffering, from both global competition and intra-European competition. Germany, with its labor market reforms dating back to the middle of the last decade, has made itself the competitive juggernaut in Europe, and France has been losing out to competition from Germany and the Netherlands and a few other states.
Now, is there anyone who can keep up with Germany in Europe at this point?
At this point, no. Perhaps the Netherlands is the only real competitor, and the Scandinavian economies, which are specialized in certain niches. But France has been losing substantial portions of its manufacturing base, and French firms have been less adroit in responding to the shifting competitive situation in Europe. They've done less outsourcing to Eastern European countries and to Southern European countries than the Germans have, in part because of the political difficulty of doing that in France. The French unions, the French government, even the right-wing French government under Sarkozy took a dim view of outsourcing and tried to jawbone auto manufacturers, for example, who wanted to outsource Eastern Europe into retaining their operations in France, and that has made it difficult for those companies to compete with Germany, which has been aggressive in its outsourcing.
I noticed on your blog recently you noted that Sarkozy has disappeared from the French memory almost the way that George Bush did from ours. What's his legacy, if any?
He was a strong personality who has left vivid impressions on the French electorate, but a lot of those impressions were negative, and the French were glad to see his back. He did better, actually, in the election than he was expected to, which suggests that the socialists are in for an equally rough ride, but Hollande has been largely without fault since taking office. Of course, it's still very early in his presidency. And has changed the style of the presidency considerably. He's much lower key than Sarkozy. He's not confrontational. And that has helped him overcome the first early hurdles.
Now, the socialist strategy, what do they plan to, what's their strategy for dealing with this economic crisis?
Well, that's the $64 question. Hollande benefited from the resentment that was growing in Europe against the so-called Merkozy agreement, which Merkel and Sarkozy had worked out before the election, I think largely in order to hold things together so that Sarkozy could run his reelection campaign on having saved the euro. That became less and less credible as the euro seemed not to remain saved after several valiant attempts. And Hollande became de facto the leader of the anti-austerity faction in Europe. But that was largely, I think, based on a misinterpretation. I think both Sarkozy and Hollande would have attempted to reverse the austerity policy that Sarkozy had agreed to. If Sarkozy had been reelected, he would have done the same thing that Hollande has done, which is to join with the southern economies, Italy and Spain, to try to get Germany to loosen its terms. So insofar as Hollande has a strategy, I think that's what it is. It's to try to persuade Merkel that it's not in Germany's interest to drive the southern economies into failure and possibly social rebellion. Explosion is greatly to be feared in societies like Spain and Italy, where unemployment is running at 25% and youth unemployment is over 50% in Spain. That's not really a viable situation. And Hollande recognizes that, as do the southern European leaders. I think Merkel also recognizes it, but is hemmed in by her own opposition, by her coalition partners, by strong elements within her own party. So exactly what Hollande is able to accomplish against the consensus that has formed in Germany against going farther in the direction of alleviating the austerity program that has been agreed to remains to be seen.
I'm speaking with Art Goldhammer, who is a senior affiliate at the Harvard Center for European Studies. How do you read the German strategy? What do they want? I mean, they can't get blood from a stone, but they seem to be trying.
They do indeed seem to be trying. I think Merkel wants to be reelected in 2013, and unfortunately, the elections are too far away. The euro will probably come under additional pressure, severe pressure before then. And Germany will have to make its decision before the elections have either strengthened Merkel's position or brought in a new coalition. I really find it difficult to interpret Germany's strategy. I don't know what Germany thinks will be the end game here. But I do know that the petition signed by 200 economists led by Hans Werner Sinn, saying that Merkel has already conceded too much and has really surrendered to the southern interests, is an alarming sign that the opposition to Germany is quite strong and quite organized, and that Merkel will find it very, very difficult to change her course.
Is there some materialist motivation that one can read in German actions, or do we need to call in the psychoanalyst to decode German policy?
Well, I think the explanation of German policy is that the Germans are doing quite well right now and that they think that they made sacrifices that other countries should also make. It's not that they're unaware of the severe sacrifices they've imposed on Greece, but in their view, they made sacrifices of their own when they took in East Germany. Made adjustments to their economic policy that were quite painful, instituted the series of reforms known as the Hartz reforms, which altered labor market regulations and reduced unemployment benefits, among other things. These moves were very unpopular in Germany, but the German political class believes that the fact that it was willing to confront severe opposition domestically in order to impose painful reforms was a move of great virtue, and they want to see other countries in Europe emulate what they consider to be their virtuous behavior. So insofar as psychoanalysis can explain things, I think that's the psychoanalytic explanation. They feel that they've made sacrifices, and they want to see others do the same.
Returning to French strategy, is there any area that the French economy could be competitive in for the longer term that's worth emphasizing, or is it just going to be a losing battle with the German monster?
The French have considerable strengths, particularly in the area of science and technology. They have a well-developed industry in laser technology. They're advanced in aviation control technology, for example. They're a strong partner in Airbus. They compete in, extremely well in a number of high-tech areas. The fact that the French economy is not moribund is demonstrated by the fact that it's one of the prime destinations for foreign direct investment, which shows that foreign investors think that the French labor force has many skills to offer and that the French economy has many advantages, being centrally located in Europe, a very fine road network, good transportation, offering access to other European markets. So France does have all of those strengths, and it has sought to increase those advantages by investing more in research and development and in universities. One of the, you asked earlier about Sarkozy's legacy, one of the legacies that I think will last of his reforms is the reform of the university system, which he undertook. And he it was not simply an organizational reform, he backed it up with money. There was something called the Le Grand Emprunt, the big loan. They went to the capital markets and borrowed over €1 billion to invest in universities and in science and technology. They've reorganized the universities to combine the independent R&D structure called the CNRS that existed in France alongside, in parallel with the universities. And they're trying to integrate those two more closely in order to bring students more directly into scientific research. So I think France is trying to shift out of the old manufacturing industries, the Rust Belt industries, if you will, into these more advanced sectors. The problem, of course, as with all advanced economies, is that these advanced sectors don't employ as many people as the old industries that they're supplanting. So France is going to have to specialize more in exportable services, and it hasn't quite figured out how to do that yet.
So the French haven't taken the American approach of savaging university budgets?
No, they haven't. And in fact, they're trying to strengthen the leading universities. One of the problems in France has been that their university spending has been dispersed over a very large system. There are something like 85 public universities. They're trying now to consolidate so that more money will go into a few select universities, which will become what they call poles of excellence, that will unify leading universities with another French anomaly, which is called the Grandes Écoles. These are elite institutions that existed outside the normal university system, where students were actually selected quite carefully and then paid to receive their education. They not only got a free education, but they received a salary while they were getting that. And the French are trying to receive those, to combine those very elite, prestigious institutions with some of their top universities and concentrate their spending on those rather than disperse spending over the entire system. That's not good news for those at the lower end of the system, but it probably will produce results in the short term.
And turning to politics, how much do we worry about the threat from the far right?
Well, I think there is a good deal to worry about there. Marine Le Pen did better by a point or so than her father did in the 2002 election, which was the previous high watermark for the Front National. And there is the Front National is now the leading working class party in France. It receives more votes from industrial workers than any other party. In the last presidential election, it made considerable inroads into geographical regions of the country that had never been strongholds of the Front National before. So it is expanding its influence. And as the Socialist Party moves more toward the center, which I think is a fair characterization of the policy, the economic policy being followed under Hollande, unless it's very careful, it's probably going to lose more working class votes as we see the ramifications of its relatively neoliberal economic policy in events like the closing of the Peugeot plant at Onet that I mentioned earlier. So the Front National is picking up strength there. And it's funny, just this morning I had an email chat with a young Frenchman who had been quite an enthusiastic supporter of Ségolène Royal for many years. I hadn't heard from him for a year or so, and suddenly this morning I got an email in which he announced to me with great pride that he had become a supporter of Marine Le Pen. So I think that this is quite symptomatic of what's happening to the French working class.
And what is the appeal? Is this the disappointment with the left, or is there some positive appeal to, what, xenophobia or what?
Part of the appeal is xenophobia, but I think the stronger reason for the expansion of the audience of the National Front in recent years has been the emphasis on protectionism. It's an economic policy that is directly aimed at the European Union, which is seen as the thin end of the neoliberal wedge, and on the changes that that has wrought in the French economy that we've been discussing for the past 10 minutes. The Front National is quite candid about wanting to withdraw from the European Union, get off the euro, close the borders, and go back to a closed economy. Now, in many ways, this is a completely unrealistic strategy, in part because of the fact that France is a deeply integrated global player. It's not only a recipient of foreign direct investment, as I mentioned earlier, but is also a major investor abroad itself. And probably I've seen an estimate recently that 7 to 10 million jobs depend directly on firms doing business in the global economy. So protectionism would, if it were ever to be instituted in France, would have an immediate dislocating effect on the economy that the Front National doesn't acknowledge at all. But it has been a potent message in attracting new voters to the party.
And finally, how different would things be in terms of politics and policy had DSK not had that unfortunate incident in the New York hotel room?
I think actually Hollande is following a policy quite similar to the policy that DSK had in mind. His several of his key economic players, including the Minister of Economy and Finance, Pierre Moscovici, were former lieutenants of DSK. Moscovici was slated to be DSK's campaign manager. Instead, he became Hollande's campaign manager when DSK was forced out of the race. So I think that Hollande has quietly occupied the niche of the party that DSK had been building for himself. Now, that move toward the center and the fact that the centrist candidate won the presidential election caused a rift in the left. As you may recall, during the election campaign, there was a strong run made by Jean-Luc Mélenchon, representing a party called the Left Front Party. Mélenchon, in the end, didn't do as well as he was expected to do. In fact, what he did was consolidate the votes that have traditionally floated around among various candidates of the extreme left in France. There are several Trotskyist parties. There's the rump of the old Communist Party, and then there's a small group of dissident former socialists, of whom Mélenchon himself was one. So he consolidated all those votes and still managed to get only about 9% of the electorate. But that extreme left could grow if disillusionment with the socialist policies should increase over the course of Hollande's term. There are some voters in the working class who simply will not go over to the Front National for reasons of traditional enmity between the extreme left and the extreme right, and those voters may find themselves drawn to the Left Front Party. So there's a possibility that the socialists could lose support on their left as well as their right.
I was Art Goldhammer, a senior affiliate at the Center for European Studies at Harvard, who blogs on French politics at artgoldhammer.blogspot.com. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break to talk about neoliberal school reform.
We don't need no education.
and was some of Another Brick in the Wall by Pink Floyd, a cheap setup for my next segment. I've shied away from interviewing Liza Featherstone, a journalist who writes a lot about the politics of education, because she's my wife, and I don't want to appear like a nepotist. But, one, she's really good at it, and I'd think so even if she weren't my wife, and two, I stand to make no material gain with this interview. Liza Featherstone. We just learned, the Bloomberg administration, very proud of this fact, that New York City students improved their scores on math and reading tests significantly this year. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, it's always good news when people are reading better and doing math better and learning more. But I think we should take these test scores with a fair amount of skepticism for a couple reasons. One, the obsession with testing and with test scores has resulted in a fanatical emphasis on test prep in the classroom, with the result that better test scores may simply mean that children are just spending more time in the classroom being prepared simply to take tests, which may mean, in fact, that they're learning less. They may be spending less time freely reading books, less time in music classes, less time on social studies and science, and you know, things that are not so rigorously tested. So I'm not even sure that it's a good thing to see these advances in test scores. It may be even be a sign that the test prep mania has escalated.
What are they using these tests for?
Certainly, if you ask well-intentioned people in some Department of Education circles, they will say, look, you know, we have to have some way of figuring out whether students are learning. You know, we owe that to students to find out if they are, in fact, learning to read. Are they learning to do math? You know, are they gaining basic skills? I wouldn't take that entirely at face value. I think that that yes, there is a need to measure whether students have basic skills, but we're also seeing that these test scores are being used to more intensely marketize our education system. So test scores are used to determine which schools will stay open. We see insane rush to close schools because of a quote-unquote lack of progress in test scores. Most of the schools that get closed down have a disproportionate amount of very low-income students, even homeless students, special needs students, English language learners. It's much more difficult to show test score gains with these populations of students, and you're going to see more and more that the incentive will be for teachers not to teach these groups of students, because teachers will be penalized for not showing test score gains. So I would say that the tests are used both to escalate competition among schools. So while some schools will quote unquote fail because they won't be able to show the good test scores, this will promote more school choice, will justify the opening of more privatized models, especially charter schools. We're also seeing it as a labor force discipline mechanism where teachers are increasingly judged on these test scores. And I think that that should be just as troubling, that a teacher may be penalized for not showing enough quote-unquote progress. This penalizes teachers both who teach the you know, riskier special ed low-income students. It actually also penalizes teachers who teach gifted students, because they have often scored so well that they can't do much better the following year. You know, so we see these ridiculous disincentives to teach anything other than the absolute average person. So I think that what we're seeing is that it's basically a cumbersome but effective tool of neoliberalizing our education system.
Well, I'm sure a partisan would hear that and say, yes, that's the idea. You're giving a pejorative spin on it, but they're introducing objective metrics, as they like to say, and the threat of closure, failure, economic death. Firms fail. Why not schools? Why not make the schools more like the economic world these students will eventually graduate into?
Yes, I think that some of them would perfectly cheerfully admit that that's what they're doing, and I think that the rest of us should really resist that model, because public education is something that we all benefit from. We would all benefit from having a society in which everybody was well educated, in which everybody learned to think critically, in which everybody had. Everybody had skills, the skills not only to perform on the job, but to think more deeply about things and to think more deeply about how to solve the many problems that our society faces. What we don't benefit from a model which guarantees some children and some schools to failure and ensures that some will be invested in while others are left by the wayside. I mean, we really would benefit from thinking about education in a different way. I think we would benefit from thinking of it as something that is a right, that everybody is entitled to a great education. Everybody's school should get enough resources. Everybody's teachers should get the support that they need to do a great job. And this model of competition doesn't do that. It ensures by definition that only a few will get the federal top race to the top dollars. Only a few students will win the lottery to get into the charter schools. You know, it's by definition a winner-loser model, and I think when we consider that we're looking at children's futures, that's really pretty uncivilized. It's like running a hospital on a winner-loser.
We're getting there.
We are getting there.
And before we go on, we should say that the New York City, most of the people listening to this show are not in New York City, but New York City is kind of a laboratory for education reform around the country, right?
That's right. New York is important for everybody to pay attention to, not just because we live here and it's the center of the world, but because it is really the laboratory, and the people making our education policy are unfortunately extremely nationally influential. For instance, we see that Bloomberg, our mayor, not the company, although it's a fine distinction, is responsible for funding the campaigns of a number of school officials in Louisiana who are now successfully privatizing that state system. I find it very interesting because these people in New York are really thinking very hard about and setting policy for people elsewhere. Bloomberg and his friends are very sophisticated, smart people who have had the benefit of excellent educations, as have their children. And yet, you know, the models that they're promoting in places like Louisiana, where they're encouraging voucher systems that are even being used for completely unaccredited, even religious schools, while they're, you know, sophisticated and sending their children to places like Spence, they're condemning the rest of the country to live in what Charles Peirce has called idiot America, a place where the idea that dinosaurs roam the earth at the same time as people is a serious proposition.
We shouldn't be elitist about these things.
I don't think it's elitist at all. I'm saying that you know, these elites are happy to condemn the rest of us to living in idiocy. I mean, and I, you know, and I don't think that's okay.
I want to return to the topic of idiocy in a moment. I should say, I'm speaking with Liza Featherstone, who does the report card column for the Brooklyn Rail. Before we get to the rich topic of idiocy, charter schools, how exactly do they fit into this whole strategy?
They're important. They're important only because they're a piece of the plan to more deeply marketize and the school system and make competition far more of a driving force. So the Bloomberg administration has been very responsive to charter school interests, opens lots of charter schools. School closures, the closing of so-called failing schools, often seem motivated by making space for more charter schools to open within those same buildings,
which are mostly non-union, right?
Yeah, and so the charter schools are really important, both because they introduce more competition into the system, putting more pressure on the traditional schools, creating more performance pressure. They're also important in weakening the bargaining power of teachers, weakening the labor market power, because the charter schools are mostly non-union, and the teachers are much more poorly paid. They're worked far more hours, and so they're
and they're likely to burn out and move on more quickly.
They do. The teacher turnover at these schools is very high, as, by the way, is principal turnover. The principals in charter schools are in many charter schools it's really a revolving door, partly because these things are very new and untested, and it's hard to find people who can make these startups work. But it's also teacher turnover, because the teachers are worked incredibly hard, and they're not paid very well. They're generally pretty young and inexperienced. And the ideology is that it's great because they have so much energy, unlike the sort of stereotypical time-serving, civil servant school teacher that of stereotype. But the reality is, they're not very experienced, and they're really, really exploited. In some places, we're seeing that that charter school teachers are starting to form unions or try to, and that will be interesting. And if they really begin to do that in large numbers, that will somewhat change the dynamic, and will change the balance of forces a bit.
Let's talk about some of the forces behind school reform, as they say. A Bloomberg, fine example. Mm-hmm. Wall Street, hedge fund guys, and a handful of foundations, right? Who are some of these characters?
Yeah, I mean, Bloomberg is really exemplifies the edu reformers. A lot of them are finance industry bigwigs, but particularly from corners of from the most unregulated corner of the finance industry, a lot of hedge fund, a lot of private equity, these are people who really, they find that relatively unregulated capitalism has done great things for them, and in many cases, they sincerely believe, therefore, that it can do great things for poor black children.
Now, it should be, I'll underscore that point. I mean, these people really believe what they're doing.
I think that many of them do, yes. I think there are also fairly amoral profiteers who see a growing market. I think you certainly see that in the textbook industry and the for-profit charter school industry, which is actually huge, not in New York, because we still actually don't let them in yet. But elsewhere in the country, you see for-profit charter schools, and you see all kinds of charlatans raking in, ridiculous salaries. We saw in Philadelphia, people who had several positions as CEOs of different for-profit charter schools, and they couldn't possibly have been working full-time at both, and they're just, completely robbing and looting the public sector. So you do see that kind of kleptocracy at work. But the driving forces behind neoliberal school reform, I do believe, are mostly pretty sincere people, many of them in the finance industry, who do genuinely believe that this model is going to work better.
And there are foundations too.
And there are foundations as well. And many of them are now working through AstroTurf groups like Students First and Stanford Children, which will sort of appear to make a pretense of being grassroots groups, but they are mostly funded by people in the finance industry who have particular ideas about education reform. Michelle Rhee, the former schools head of Washington, D.C., is a major player in these groups now. Again, another sincere person. I'm sure she could make more money doing something else. I think these people really do believe that unions are the enemy, and that the public schools could benefit from greater competition. There's absolutely no evidence to support those contentions, though they really are kind of, I guess, analogous to the idea that dinosaurs work to walk the earth at the same time as people. There's not much evidence to support their belief. I mean, school systems with greater union, with more unionized teaching forces, actually seem to perform better academically.
Well, yeah, Massachusetts got the top scores in the country, right? 100% unionized.
Yeah.
Mississippi,
yeah.
Some of the worst.
Yeah.
Hardly unionized at all.
Yeah, yeah. And the for-profit charter schools overall perform much worse than the nonprofit and traditional education sector. The charter schools themselves overall don't perform better than traditional public schools. So there's no empirical basis for these contentions, but they are deeply believed, and they're deeply believed by very powerful people who have a lot of lobbying.
Well, and some of them, especially like charter schools, if they break unions, can save money.
Yeah, and they're very appealing for this reason, because austerity is a crucial partner in this privatization agenda. That the more the public sector is starved of resources, the better the privatized models look, at least from the outside. I mean, our kid goes to an absolutely awesome traditional public school, and you still have parents looking at the charter schools because the charter schools have two teachers in a classroom. Because they can't afford to, because the teachers are like 12 years old and they're paying them very little, and because, at our school there are 25 students in a kindergarten because of a lack of resources. As you starve the public schools, then there starts to seem to people to be more of a need for the private sector to come in on its white horse and help the people out. In many ways, these things are just absolutely intertwined. I mean, if we resist the austerity, then there would be very little public support for the privatization. But as it is, it starts to seem necessary to people.
And it just strikes me that the intellectuals who are behind these moves congregate around places like the Brookings Institution, traditionally identifies a Democratic think tank. The Hoover Institution, like our friend Terry Moe, who was on this show a little over a year ago, the Hoover Institution at Stanford. It's kind of reminiscent of 70s deregulation, when Brookings and the American Enterprise Institute were producing indistinguishable studies promoting deregulation. So this has become a bipartisan affair. Like the Democrats have pretty much given up on teachers' unions and public education.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. Center for American Progress, the kinds of recommendations that they put out on education are pretty much now indistinguishable from the right-wing think tanks.
And Secretary of Education.
Yeah, and our Secretary of Education is certainly pursuing an agenda that it's a little softer now. I mean, they have rolled back some of the No Child Left Behind provisions. But that's because, by the way, the resistance has been bipartisan as well. I mean, some of the more conservative states, like Texas, have resisted some of the testing pressures and privatization pressures. So
1.5 cheers for states' rights.
Yeah, exactly. But I would say absolutely this has become bipartisan, and that's a crucial part of the story. Here in Brooklyn, we have a fellow running for Congress, Hakeem Jeffries. He's unusually progressive. He's just all for raising minimum wages, and he's done great work on affordable housing, against the racial harassment of young Black men. Just crucial issues to our community, and he's a hero to the forces of school privatization and. Because he has worked to lift the cap on charter schools in this state. And the day that he won the Democratic nomination, he said that he would work to relieve the, quote, crushing burden, unquote, to families of religious education, which is was a not so thinly coded way of saying that he would pursue some sort of vouchers for private and religious schools. And this is what most progressives would consider our guy. I mean, the Working Families Party called him the candidate of the 99%. So, it's very troubling that liberals have so wholesale abandoned public education when it's hard to think of a more worthy liberal ideal.
And we're just about out of time, but whenever I've had people talking about education in the past, they've shied away from this question. Perhaps you would. The complex tasks of approaching education in such a profoundly anti-intellectual country. Most of the progressive pundits I've talked to on this issue think it's not a problem. They don't want to talk about it. I think it's a problem. Do you think it's a problem?
It's a terrible problem. I mean, reforming education in this country is always a challenge because we don't fundamentally value ideas. We don't fundamentally value learning. We have a deep distrust of experts and intellectuals. I mean, this is going back quite a long way. I mean, Richard Hofstadter talks about this in his great book on anti-intellectualism. Catherine Liu, in her excellent newer book on anti-elitism, takes it in new directions, showing that, unlike what Hofstadter argued, it's not only a right-wing problem, it's also a left-wing problem, and across the spectrum, very deep problem in American life. So I think it's a huge part of the reason why our schooling is not better. If you basically don't value ideas and learning, you are not going to invest in the institutions and the people who do it. If we really valued learning, we would have, we would really invest, for instance, in our teachers. I mean, in Finland, teachers have master's degrees in the subjects that they teach. Very hard to find people like that here who would go into such a disrespected and degraded and difficult and exploited profession. But if we really valued teaching and we're not such an anti-intellectual society, it would be a much more appealing profession to go into. And I think that it's, absolutely, we would fund schools better and we would invest in them more. It's important to say, though, that this new chapter, with this move toward greater privatization and greater marketization of the system, is making the anti-intellectualism in our system even more profound, and moving us toward even greater stupidity, as we start to see people being put in charge of schools who are not educators, but people from the business world whose business is numbers and outcomes. In many cases, in the case of the for-profit schools, their goal is returning a profit to shareholders. What could be a more deeply at odds with actual intellectualism and learning? You know, I think that we're going to see that problem get much worse unless we do something about it.
That was Liza Featherstone, who does the report card column on school politics for the Brooklyn Rail. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Journey by Ben Klock, remixed by Ellen Naline. Till next week, bye.